powers on the ground. So America is increasingly shrinking from the region. It's losing its strategic importance to it because all of their plans have been thwarted one after the other by the resistance movements on the ground that have only been gaining strength. So when we look at the Abraham Accords, we need to see it within the context of the deal of the century that was put forward that supposedly alluded that it wanted to find a solution to the Palestinian issue. That was not actually the case due to the fact that there was not a single Palestinian representative that was present. And even the PA, which was born out of Oslo, rejected this deal. That shows you the extent to which it was just unfathomable in terms of, you know, supposedly coming up with a solution. Rather, what the Abraham Accords was about, as was just mentioned over here, was forming a kind of united, coordinated front on the ground, an alliance that could actually confront the resistance axis that has been against American hegemony and that has been jeopardizing their interests. If we see with Biden's recent visit to the Middle East, there's been a lot of talk over kind of the void that is now emerging as America is withdrawing from the region. So right now, America's focus isn't so much on leveraging resources. I mean, it's milked the region and it hasn't gained much from that in the past 2 decades. Rather, its main focus is on not allowing Russia and China to strategically benefit from the region. So it's important that as it's leaving, it leaves behind a kind of united coalition and force that could serve its interests, as obviously now the battle with America is shifting from the Middle East elsewhere with Russia, that is obviously threatening its the unipolar nature of American hegemony.
No, indeed. And when you refer to the PA, you're referring to the Palestinian
Authority. The Palestinian Authority, exactly.
Yeah, of course, yeah. David, just tell me, I mean, what do you make of this media company, the Daily Wire, that produced the Jordan Peterson video?
Well, it's a bit of a stunning investigation that's been done here. So all credit to the people who dug this up. So this is an organisation which you wouldn't necessarily have known about. And it's actually set up by this guy called Ben Shapiro, who has vile racist anti-Palestinian views. Its project is to support the Israeli foreign policy objectives, and normalisation is a key part of that. We often think that media organisations, even right-wing media organisations, are something of a black box where you don't look into their politics. But it's very clear from the investigation that's been done here that this is a pushing Zionist interests, and Peterson appears on the face of it to be simply the latest face of Zionist normalisation.
I mean, Batul, how do you think Muslims should respond to Jordan Peterson's message to them?
So there's a very famous quote by a man called Ali ibn Abi Talib, in which he says that there is a word of truth in which evil is intended by it. If we look at the Quran, there's a verse that says, O mankind, we created you of nations and tribes so that you may get to know one another. The best amongst you is the most pious. Meaning that Islam's default position over here is go out, build links, ties, form relationships, but it needs to be on the basis of upholding key principles and values. Now, if you look at the essence of the Abraham Accords, what is it trying to fixate? It's trying to fixate one of the biggest shames to have occurred, and that is the dispossession of the Palestinians through the world superpowers colliding to dispossess them to fulfill their interests. That is what is being normalized. Further on to that, they are using the title of Abraham. Now, Abraham is known as the father of all three Abrahamic faiths, right? And he is known to be actually one of the most revolutionary figures to actually walk this earth with his message of actually standing up and challenging the unjust status quo. So it's almost like a lie so big, such as normalizing the Zionist regime, requires a name so big, such as Abraham, in order to kind of put it under that kind of moral guise, to justify it and to play around with perceptions so that people's minds get distorted.
Sure, of course. I mean, just turning again, David, to the Daily Wire. I mean, you know, they've been employing people who previously worked for US military intelligence. Do you think that's an issue?
Well, yes. I mean, we've seen on this programme time and time again organisations which appear to be neutral or apolitical or present themselves as such, who have all sorts of people who've previously been in intelligence organisations, quite often Israeli intelligence organisations, but also the US and indeed in the UK. I mean, this is an issue. I mean, these are people who have learned skills when they were intelligence officers, which they will go on to apply in their new posts. But it also raises the question about whether they still remain intelligence officers. I mean, one of the ways in which intelligence operates is that people are given cover positions in corporations while they still maintain an intelligence role. So we should raise those kinds of questions. Maybe it's the case these people have all retired, but equally they will remain and will retain links with their previous employers, whether that's Unit 820 in the state of Israel in the Zionist regime, or whether it's in the FBI or in the CIA. So these are, or the or military intelligence, indeed. So these are really serious concerns, which seems to affect a whole range of organisations throughout civil society, not just media organisations, but a whole range more.
Yes, and you know, Unit 8200, if you just want to just briefly explain what that is.
Unit 8200 is the signals intelligence unit of, yes, of the Zionist regime. So it's like GCHQ, sure, in the UK, or like the National Security Agency,
of course,
in the US, you know, yeah, the organisations with which, for example, Edward, yeah, Snowden, sure, was associated.
Batul, I mean, do you think Jordan Peterson was just being mischievous when he was suggesting a pen pal system across sectarian lines, or do you think he was being genuine?
It's an interesting question of actually who is sowing the seeds of discord. If we look at even those who brokered the Abraham Accords, for example, America, right? Mm-hmm. It's these imperialist nations that actually seek to kind of weaponize and stoke the seeds of sectarianism, which are dormant within the hearts of average individuals in order to serve their callous interests. Mm-hmm. Take, for example, the creation, the initiation and the funding of ISIS. You know, they considered ISIS to be this key strategic organization that could fight the line of resistance that had a kind of Shia characterization, if, yes, we're looking at that which is spearheaded by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So obviously ISIS fought the line of resistance under the sectarian notion, whereas if you look at how the resistance fought them, they fought them as part of the conspiracy of the American project for the region. So the point that I'm trying to allude to over here is that they are the ones that sow the seeds of these discords, yes, and they make a non-issue to be an issue, and then they come and say, you're uncivilized, you know, you two need to come together to sort your house out, basically. Yes. And it's important that we also allude to the reality on the ground is that this is not an issue in the, yes, region. What is an issue is the divide between the first world and the third world. The, yes, issue is the divide between the East and the West. Of, as, course, the capitalists, they gain monopoly over land, wealth and resources, whilst the people of this land are impoverished. These are the issues that we need, yeah, to be talking about. These are the solutions that we need to be finding.
Well, we'd just have to pause there for a second. And of course, you know, the ISIS example is not a unique one, is it? But we just want to now have a look at this report on the Abraham Global Peace Initiative.
Another interesting link in the Peterson chain to the Abraham Accords is his connection with Israel lobby group, the Abraham Global Peace Initiative, based in his home country of Canada. The organization, which claims involvement in Morocco normalizing relations with Israel, was established to, quote, give strength to the Abraham Accords. The board of the Abraham Global Peace Initiative features General Moshe Yaalon, former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, Minister of Strategic Affairs and head of the Israeli military. It also includes Brigadier General Amir Avivi, former head of auditing for the Israeli military establishment, including the Israel Occupation Force and the Israeli military industries. Ralph Nurnberger was legislative liaison at the infamous Israeli lobby group AIPAC for many years and now graces the board of AGPI with his presence. Another Israeli military figure featured on the board of this normalization group is Colonel Kobi Marom, a former brigadier commander of the Israeli military during the failed occupation of South Lebanon. The former deputy chief of mission at the Israeli embassy, Dan Arbil, sits on the board too, alongside Yoel Hassan, a former president of the World Zionist Congress and personal counselor to Ariel Sharon. The British Israel lobby group, the Board of Deputies, even has a presence, with their vice president, Edwin Shuker, holding a position on the board of the AGPI. Flor Hassan Nahum, the mayor of Occupied Jerusalem and founder of the UAE Israel Business Council, is also present in this rogues gallery of board members. The Abraham Global Peace Initiative is also home to an assortment of current and former Canadian security personnel and the senior rabbi of the UAE, Dr. Eli Abadi. Peterson has consistently publicly supported the work of AGPI board member Richard Cravats. When Cravats accused members of the US Congress who oppose US military aid to the Israeli military of anti-Semitism, Peterson publicly supported this unoriginal Israeli lobby tactic and tweeted the sad excuse for an article by Cravats to his millions of followers. There are several very prominent supporters of Peterson within the AGPI. The founder, Avi Ben-Lolo, has written about the supposed campaign to silence the Canadian academic, Another board member, Mohamed Tahwidi, has heralded Peterson as, quote, one of the greatest, smartest and brightest scholars to ever contribute to human thought. He went on to tweet Peterson's message to Muslims with the hashtag Abraham Accords. It appears that Peterson has been enlisted as a cultural weapon in the war to integrate the economies of key Arab states with the Israeli one, a danger to all.
David, what do you make of the revelations in the film there about this Abraham Global Peace Initiative?
Well, I mean, we, over the last however many weeks we've been doing the show, every week we come across new Israel lobby groups we haven't heard of before, which are exposed as having covert or overt Zionist links. And here's another one, extraordinary. I mean, even in the process of researching this, we came across a further one which has got an almost identical name, which has got the Abraham Accords in its title and Peace Institute. And so there's a huge rash of these organisations set up to embed and further and lobby on the Abraham Accords. There are literally thousands of Zionist organisations all over the world. I mean, almost thousands in the UK itself, and certainly many thousands in the US. So it's a kind of whack-a-mole situation, isn't it, where we spot one organisation and then a few days later there's another one and another one. And this really shows the huge effort that goes into this. It's not just Israeli intelligence and money and Zionist foundations. It's a huge effort which is internally networked. Muslim apparent scholars, and of course his credentials for being a scholar are extremely minimal, as you will have seen if you've read anything about him. And to try and present this as being what Muslims should do. They should get in bed with the Zionists. They should pretend that the Palestinians haven't been dispossessed. They should pretend that there's not ongoing ethnic cleansing and indeed a slow genocide in Palestine, and pretend that we can all be nice to each other. And this is not the way to produce peace or justice.
I mean, and they often sort of adopt benign sounding and worthy names, don't they? But that's sort of part of the subterfuge, no doubt. But Batul, isn't it interesting that this lobby group was seemingly established to strengthen the Abraham Accords? I mean, how did the resistance groups in the region respond to these machinations?
Right. The reality is that the resistance doesn't really get dragged to the squares that they want them to be dragged into.
No,
they have their own line, they have their own set of aims, and they have their own trajectory. And they respond to threats as they arise on the ground, and not political talks. Mm. It's actions on the ground that are threatening, whether it's economic, whether it's military, that they would respond to, and they will use the tools at their disposal for those objectives. But on a whole, the trajectory of the resistance is one of securing the interests for the people of the region. It's to ensure that the people of the region have their own independent voices and they can curate and craft their own destinies. Mm. So at the heart of this, we need to understand that this is why the resistance is actually being targeted, and actually the resistance is actually spearheading the real message of Abraham, which is one of dignity and freedom.
Indeed. I mean, David, I mean, the Global Peace Initiative works closely with the Canadian police and the security services there, doesn't it? It's a familiar tactic, isn't it? And it's been deployed by the Israel lobby in Britain. I mean, can you give us one or two examples of how they've kind of operated in Britain?
Well, I mean, the key examples in the US and in Britain are, in the case of Britain, the Community Security Trust, and in the case of the US, the Anti-Defamation League, which are kind of parallel organisations. So their main aim, they say, is to combat anti-Semitism. But, of course, they deliberately blur anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, and they regard anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism as being more or less coterminous. And they are deeply, deeply integrated with the police in this country and in the US with the FBI. Indeed, the ADL back to the 1940s, even before the creation of the State of Israel, was collaborating with the FBI and informing on people to the FBI and trying to, they were spying on Arab American activists and trying to have them deported or locked up. And it's the same with the Community Security Trust here. They maintain huge files on Muslims, on people on the left, indeed on anti-Zionist Jews. Huge files on some anti-Zionist Jews, which I've seen. And they use these to defame these people and to accuse them of being anti-Semitic, and they use them to pass on to the Home Office and indeed to the intelligence services. So there's a very strong relationship between the Zionist movement and the intelligence and police services in both this country and in the US and maybe other countries too.
Can you also say a word or two about the board members of the Abraham Global Peace Initiative, David?
Well, I mean, you see, the film says, a rogues gallery. I mean, these are people who have very senior roles in the Zionist entity, and the Minister for Strategic Affairs, which, of course, was given the job in 2015 of been the main ministry to combat boycott, divestment and sanctions all around the world. Mm. People who've had all sorts of connections with the Israel occupation forces and indeed with, you know, the direct repression of the Palestinians. So you can see the kind of character of it from those kinds of people. And you, the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, who is a proud settler, that's the trajectory, isn't it? They pretend that the occupation, which they call the occupation of the West Bank and the Golan, is just some kind of thing which we no longer pay attention to, and that really all the new settlements that they're building are just a process we can't stop. Well, of course, you know, none of that's true. The occupation of the West Bank, indeed of the whole of Palestine, could be reversed, and that's what we see in the future for the resistance.
Yeah. I mean, Batul, I mean, you've written, haven't you, about the reverse effects of bribe normalisation. I wonder if you could briefly tell us a little bit about your observations on that.
Sure. I think that the crux of the issue is that the Abraham Accords came up from a position of weakness and not strength. I mean, Israel was an entity that never dreamed of leaving South Lebanon in 2000 when it was forced to unilaterally withdraw, for example. In addition to 2005, when it unilaterally withdrew from Gaza, for example, we see that all the battles that it fought from 2008 to 12 to 14 to 21 have failed. And then consider also the embargoes, the sieges, the sanctions that have been on the resistance line as a whole, of course, because this is a coordinated resistance axis, right? So when all of those have failed, when the Western strategy for the region has failed, what do they resort to? They start to resort to kind of empty talks, sound bombs. And the open normalization of ties is an example of this, because it's not like the resistance has basically lost any allies, and it's not like Israel has gained any allies. Yeah. It's simply a question of relations going from being under the table to now being over the table. Yes, it might have in some respects facilitated the security, the military operations, the economic outputs and ties, but in terms of people's perceptions, if you now quiz in Egypt or Jordan, I think it was yesterday the Cradle Media released one of the polls which said that only 5% of the populations of those countries, in Egypt normalized ties back in the 80s under Anwar Sadat, and Jordan and Wadi Araba in the 1990s before Oslo, only 5%. So this shows that the hearts and the minds of the people, they know what the oppression is and the reality of it. So in many ways, this is revealing those who are walking the talk and those who are normalizing ties and lowering their heads in shame. And none of the American strategies for the region has worked. Certainly this one hasn't, and it's ultimately expired in a way, the deal of the century.
Indeed. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to Batul and to David, our resident expert. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Elmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
Well, brother, today's session, I'd like to start with a parent question, which reads like, What can I do with my teenagers who does things that are completely new, sometimes or weird things like making new hairstyles or dressing in a particular way, or going out at a particular time, are very opinionated? Now, since we heard the question, how do we deal with this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is very common, as the last word of the question was very precise. A teenager who's very opinionated, very often you find that teenagers come with their own opinions and they want to do things very differently. And
true.
Very often mothers and fathers are very shocked or don't understand, can't comprehend.
What's going on?
Exactly, what's going on? What is this new thing that's coming in our lives? And how to deal with it? That's a very important question. Let me suggest a traffic light system. So traffic light, I mean, you all know what traffic light is. You have red, orange, and green. And so based on this traffic light system, you deal with this new opinion that's come in the house from this teenager in a particular way. So the green light and the traffic light is for things that are very new, the opinions that a teenager will come with, but they're not necessarily bad thing.
Okay. Right?
So for example, they're a new type of, I don't know, a clothing that has a new color. I mean, who would have thought, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, who would have thought that it was very normal for men to wear pink shirts?
Okay. Right?
Today, people are probably laughing at me like, why do you find this weird?
Are you a girl? You're looking.
No, they would find this very weird for me to ask this question. But in my generation and before that, and I'm not that old, wearing pink for a man was very, it was absolutely weird.
Okay.
Yeah, but today's world is very normal to do this. But at the same time, if you look at it, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just it's a different color, I guess, right?
Mm.
Or for example, your teenager eating a particular type of food, which is not necessarily haram, not necessarily harmful, just different, right?
Okay.
I remember some parents were claiming that my child come back and wants to eat sushi.
Okay.
I've never had sushi in my life, I guess. But there's nothing wrong with having sushi, I guess. It's a different type of food.
Okay.
From a different culture, and it's fine. So this you deal with it with the green traffic light, and you say that I'll support and I'll strengthen. Actually, I mean, there's no issue with it,
mm-hmm.
Even though it's very new, very different, something that in our family we haven't seen this before. But as long as it's not harmful, it's not haram.
It's okay.
It's okay. And not just it's okay, but we'll also support it.
Okay.
Show support.
Show support. Okay.
Don't ignore it as well. Because very often teenagers, they also want attention from this. So if they're bringing sushi at home, this is a very silly example, I know. But just as an example, if they bring sushi at home, for example.
Okay.
Be supportive. Be say, wow, I'll try it as well.
Okay.
However hard that might be, try it. Support it, strengthen it. It really builds bonds with the teenagers.
Okay, so you're trying to say that if our teenagers are trying to do some new things that sound a little weird to us, if we have to analyze if the things they are doing are in line with religion, we have to show support for them. Well, I'll talk more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic upbringing. We have Brother Miqdad with us in the studio. Brother Miqdad, you were saying like how do we deal with the teenagers who do different things?
The second light is the yellow or orange light.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is when your teenager comes with a very new thing, but that is kind of against certain principles that we have at home.
Okay.
Or in most cases, it's a borderline that with something that will very quickly could potentially turn into something haram.
Okay.
Or something harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Or thirdly, it's something that you know stems from something that's not good. So in itself, it's not a bad thing, but you know that where it's coming from is not a good thing.
Okay.
Just give you a few examples. So a particular hairstyle, but very exotic or very out there hairstyle, for example.
Okay.
So in itself, it's not a bad thing. Right? Uh-huh. It's not a haram hairstyle, but you know that it's coming from somewhere else. It's been influenced by a particular person, a particular role model,
or particular celebrity,
or you know that it can lead to something greater, more dangerous. Or take, for example, to give a couple of more examples. One is wearing, drinking drinks that are very close to alcohol but not haram.
Okay.
Right. So there are bottles of bottles of beer, for example.
Yeah.
That look exactly like beers. That even are named behind that as well, but in terms of Shar'an, they're very halal. There's nothing alcoholic in it.
Okay.
But you know from different contexts that this is coming from somewhere else.
All
right?
Right.
So it's not haram in itself, but you know that there is something behind it.
Where it drew from.
Exactly. So this is where your orange light comes up in the traffic light, where you don't necessarily
stop
it or oppose it. Right?
But you do not either support.
Exactly. So you don't support it. You observe what's happening without interfering first. Right. So, and you find out what's happening. Where does it come from? Where is a friend circle? Is it a matter of lack of confidence? Have they been watching or listening to something particular that has led to this? Find out and identify the source for this.
Okay.
And then tackle with the source. So don't oppose directly the action itself, but tackle the source and tackle it with obviously respect, with a discussion,
smartness
and tactfulness, basically, in a way that you deal. But don't, as I mentioned, don't deal with the action itself. Deal with what's happening in the background, basically. That background is the source of it. That's the way you want to tackle. And this is very important. Through different ways you can do this. Very indirect approach.
Okay.
Very often through dialogue, through finding out more. Even sometimes to taking some actions, basically.
And you also said that we don't need to interfere. We need to observe first. Because interfering.
Why? Because we need to be sure that this is. Because sometimes you could sense it, but you might not be 100% sure. So make sure you know where this is coming from first.
Yes. So research and analysis and observation is necessary before we say or do anything. Brother, I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are saying how we can deal with the teenagers who come up with weird things. Now we just discussed two forms of dealing in the form of a traffic light where you can support and where you can be a little cautious. And now, where to stop?
So the red light is where teenagers come with things that are haram. In our religion, against our Sharia, or things that are very strongly against cultural or social norms and principles that everybody deals with them or everybody lives by them, and your teenagers go against them very strongly.
Okay.
These are things that are red lights, so you oppose them. But obviously, how do we oppose them is through discussion, firstly. So you discuss with your teenager about why this is something that we don't want, basically. Respect this, why we don't like this to happen in our
house. So you have to come up with your own reason first.
Exactly. You have to discuss it.
Okay.
Never criticize the person. Never criticize the teenager says, you're a bad boy, you're a bad girl. Or
how do you do this?
Exactly. Why do you do this, etc. Always talk about the action. Say that doing this, for example, is not a right thing to do. Exactly. So never criticize a person, always talk about the action itself.
Okay.
Always show care and concern. So don't say, I'm opposing it because it's against my religion, against my house, and against my culture. No. Show concern for the person, for the teenager. Say, because I want the best for you, because I want you to be successful in life, because I want you to get closer to Allah and be happy in your life. Because of you, I'm saying that this is something that this should not be done, basically, or this is something that should stop from happening, and you should take care of not doing this. So showing a lot of care, a lot of concern, a lot of love for the teenagers, and a lot of respect as well. Understand them, hear them out. Very often you find that there might be a misunderstanding, right? So always clarify the misunderstanding. Say, okay, ask them, where does this come from? Why does this happen? What are they trying to achieve through this, by doing this? And through that, you'll be able to understand. But show your opposition to this. Show that you're not happy with it. Yeah. Have logical and clear arguments. And have clear lines as well. Self, if you do this, then this is the red line. But if you change a little bit, then you could be actually very okay.
Okay.
So, I don't know. It could be, for example, something that's haram, for example. But if they were to change a little bit, then they would actually be okay to do it.
Okay.
Take the example of music, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? Sometimes they, when you want to deal with music, you can tell them, look, if you change music, and because music is haram, this type of music, you can suggest alternative to music.
Okay.
Right? Don't say, I'll take your headphones away and you can't listen to anything. Say, this is haram, but what if you choose another type of music, for example?
You have to provide alternatives.
Exactly. And show them that you care and you understand your them. Concern. You're listening, you're concerned. And
okay. But most of the parents, you know, why they fail over here is because I think they kind of try to show power, the authority, rather than discussing things or showing concern. So you recommend and you suggest, rather than showing the authority and power, we need to show care and concern. And the best way is to discuss things with the teenagers. And when you're taking away something haram from them, you have to provide them with the alternatives, obviously with the halal alternatives. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanillah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
No power except that of the blood of Imam Hussein could affect the events of 15th of Khordad the way it did. Similarly, no power except that of these mourning gatherings can neutralize the plotting of the major powers against this nation, which is under invasion from all sides. These meetings or congregation for lamenting and reciting elegies in remembrance of the master of the oppressed, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the reciting the innocence of an oppressed person, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, who sacrificed in the path of Allah his own life and that of his own children and attendants. Yes, these morning sessions have developed young men and youth who voluntarily go to the war front seeking martyrdom and feel unhappy if they don't achieve it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that the great prophet of Islam sacrificed everything he had for Islam so as to hoist the banner of monotheism. As his followers, we should dedicate everything we have to keep that banner hoisted or to raise, keep it raised and lifted. It is very necessary, according to the teachings of the Imam Khomeini and the speech that he delivered to the Muslim nation, it is very important that the banner which was lifted and hoisted by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we must keep it hoisted in our lives. And that banner is monotheism. That banner is there is no God except Allah. And this is what we need to struggle for. We must practically show that we just believe in one God. Unfortunately, we can see in our lives there are people that who ask help from everyone other than Allah. And this shouldn't be the way. Even in our actions, in our daily routine life, we must think about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We must perform our deeds for the sake of His nearness. And therefore, if in this path, if we need to sacrifice anything, we must sacrifice it. And there is no way of opposing the teachings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because the Prophet in his time has sacrificed everything for it, because Imam Hussein has sacrificed everything for it. Therefore, we also need to struggle in order to keep it hoisted and lifted on that top, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إلا الله.
insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the US economy destroyed US production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the US dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This in turn is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazyev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us. And we welcome you to the to the club now. Well, Doctor, actually, on this point, if I may, with your permission, it's very interesting because you mentioned Zbigniew Brzezinski. He actually states very clearly in his book, this was written in the late 20th century, he says that the worst scenario for America, he clearly states this, the worst scenario for America is an alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. So this is not some like, when you are mentioning these things, when we in Iran talk about these things, these are not some sort of, you know, guesses. These are not some sort of conspiracy theories. These are things that are stated very clearly and openly by the leadership and by the elites in America. And so this is in terms of just, you know, complementing what you're saying. that, you know, it's clearly stated, just as it's very interesting for me, because the things you mentioned, my specialty is strategic studies, international relations. Many of the things that you're mentioning are said, we talk about these things in strategic studies, in international relations, of course, in our own language, in our own jargon that we have. So, for example, you mentioned the British and their whole desire since the 19th century to destroy the Russian Empire. Well, again, this is clearly stated by Halford Mackinder, who is considered the father, or so-called the founding father of modern geopolitics and geostrategic studies. Of course, he was a geographer who for the first time looked at the world as one geostrategic unit and talked about the fact that whoever wants to rule the world has to control, of course, he used his own language, but what we would call today Eurasia, that if Eurasia on its own is so big and powerful and capable of, and if we look at historically, and you know, I think there were economists in Holland that did a long-term study about this, which is that if you look at the global history, 80 to 90% of global history has been dominated in terms of the economic production and the center of civilization being in Eurasia, being in Asia. So this idea that somehow the North Atlantic or the Americans would dominate the world is actually a very strange and unusual situation that we had in human history. It's coming back to this situation where it was for centuries and for millennia. But you see people like Halford Mackinder clearly stating that their goal is to prevent any Eurasian power coming and becoming powerful and being a rival. And at that time, this is all in emphasizing the points you were making from a strategic studies perspective, that very clearly Halford Mackinder stating that the goal has to be that in no way, shape, or form should Russia and Germany be allied and be united, and that there has to always be a buffer zone between Germany and Russia where they can exploit these petty nationalisms, where these countries can either be used against Germany or can be used against Russia. Anytime there's a danger that you would see Russia or Germany becoming powerful and then uniting in terms of strategically and economically, as you were mentioning, as was already happening in the end of the 19th century. The other thing that was very interesting for me, Doctor, was that actually there's serious people who would argue that the Americans, in a way, actually also had a ministry of industry that was controlling its industrial growth after World War II. It was just called the Pentagon. It wasn't called the Ministry of Industry. It was called the Ministry of Defense. So in a way, yes, they had those corporations that were, on paper, they were private. And they were, of course, private. The profits went to the oligarchs. It created an oligarchy in the United States. But its strategic coordination was done at the Pentagon. So things like the internet, things like mobile technology, mobile phones, all those technologies that we saw, you know, emerging out of the 20th century, if you trace a lot of them back, you see even things like civilian aircraft, civilian passenger flight. A lot of these things that were technologies that transformed the world technologically, if you trace back the money, you see that at some point they went back to the Pentagon and programs that were financed. And the reason is this, Doctor, and I'm so happy we're able to talk about these things on television, which is that very rarely do you have private investors willing to invest large sums of money for something that will be profitable in 10 or 20 years. This is just not something that a private investor will do. The horizon for profitability is maximum 4 to 5 years. And this is why, in reference to the new model that you are referring to in terms of the model that is being used in China or India, but also to a certain extent in Iran, which I will talk about a little bit with your permission. So what we need is, and this is exactly actually what happened in the US as well, which is that private companies were not willing to invest into technologies such as civilian airliners, such as those other advanced technologies, because it would have taken them 10, 15 years to get the profits. So the government comes in, gives them something called a government contract. This allows them to have profits and then take those profits for themselves or invest it into other areas. I think in Iran, we had a very similar experience as you were describing with China and India. Of course, I think, this is my personal view, is that the places where we made a mistake is where we sort of blindly imitated some of those bad habits that we see in the West in terms of financialing, making the economy more financial-based, not having those controls that they have in India and in China. So all this, what I want to sum up with is that a lot of the things that you are mentioning, which is very interesting, is exactly also things that in strategic studies and international relations we also talk about, of course, in our own language. And what we say in international relations or in strategic studies is that when those realities on the ground, those technologies, those real indicators of power and wealth, when they shift and the political institutions do not shift, that's when the conflict happens. So you have a reality in the world where the Americans bankrupted themselves pretty much by 2008, if you look at the financial crisis that happened in the United States. You had the so-called war on terror. I would just suggest this to you, Doctor, that actually the hybrid war, as far as the Iranians are concerned, has been going on since the 1990s. We've been experiencing all those elements that you describe as a hybrid war in Iran since the 1990s. Of course, because the scale of the conflict was smaller, maybe a lot of people in the world didn't realize this. Of course, those who were experts understood what the Americans were doing in Iran and trying to fight Iran. All those elements that are now being used in this hybrid war against Russia and China were first used, tested, tried with Iran. And I think the interesting thing for maybe Russia and China is to look and to see how was Iran capable of resisting and not succumbing to this hybrid war. A lot of it, which of course you also indicated, which is to have that strategic management being centralized, but also taking advantage of market mechanisms and allowing both the forces that are social, but also the forces that are related to the central government being able to coordinate the different interests that exist. So with that in mind, I apologize. I just felt that there was it was very interesting to me. I wanted to add and emphasize some of the points you were saying from our perspective as strategic studies or international relations. So with that in mind, Dr. Ghazayev, what does the future look like? What is it, how is it that we're going to now move away from this system dominated by what is becoming inefficient American system, a system that is abusing that system of banking and money, which was serving it for a purpose for a period of time, and weaponizing it and using it as a political tool and weapon against different countries. One thing that maybe we could talk about is the idea that, for example, why is it that we denominate all major important commodities in the dollar? I mean, Iran has a lot of oil and gas. China, Russia has a lot of oil and gas. Why do we have to sell it in dollars to India and China? We are neighbors. We're on the same continent. How is it that things like dollar hegemony and those other things that are the markers of the current system, what is the future going to look like? How can we replace these things that are currently existing with new systems, and what are those new systems going to be? And if you could please, we don't have a lot more time left, just if you could give us the gist of it. Thank you very much.
I shall try to be brief. According to the long-term economic growth theory, it is quite clear that America is going to lose. It is no doubt that America will lose its leadership as well. The British Empire lost it a century ago. Not because we don't like America, it's because America has obsolete and, in fact, inefficient economic system. They use their financial opportunities. They still have hegemony in the world of finance. Still, American dollar dominates in all transactions, which you mentioned, in the currency reserves. But It is very important that America lost its privilege to print the world money about 1 month ago. Of course, you're right that Iran is suffering from this hybrid war about 30 years. And of course, we had to look for the Iranian experience. Unfortunately, the Russian financial elite was very confident in the American state, in American policy, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian economy becomes, in fact, the peripheral economy. It was used by the Americans as a donor, and by the Europeans. Yes. We exported raw materials, and we had capital flight about $100 billion per year. And the Russian economy was too much dependent from the American influence, especially the governance of the Russian central banks was controlled by the IMF, and IMF recommendations were implemented in Russia with catastrophic results. But America was too much, it was too much concentrated on Russophobia. Mm-hmm. And it played a bad joke with the Americans. They used their main weapon, the dominance in the world financial system, against Russia, and they did not have any cards more. The American dollar is not considered as a reserve currency anymore in Asia. Of course, you have such experience before. For you, dollar is not reserve currency for a long time. But for Russia, and now for China as well, America, and for India, I am sure, American dollar lost its image as a world currency, and America so lost its main weapon, I should say. In this book, which I showed to you, I made some recommendations. They were written about, as I mentioned, 6 years ago. And the first recommendations was to, if you want to finish this war, if you want to save the mankind from the American aggression, we have to create coalition between those countries who are not interested in the war, who want peaceful development, and who are constructing now the new world economic mode. So we have to avoid to get rid from dollar. Get rid from dollar as a world currency in trade, in reserves, in financial transactions. For Russia and for Iran, it is no question anymore. It is no question also, I think, for China. And American superpower is undermined now because the world do not believe in American dollar anymore. And we have to move as far as possible for the national currencies in our relations. And now in our economic commission, we are trying to elaborate with the Russian academician experts, trying to elaborate the model for the new world currency. Mm-hmm. It should be based on the commodity basket. As you mentioned, Russia and Iran have dominance in the oil sector.
Exactly.
We also have dominance together in the metallurgy, in the chemical sector, in water, in coal, in a lot of commodities. We can organize the common economic space, which will be independent from the Western benchmarks. What we are thinking about to create the Asian exchange. Mm-hmm. Which will generate its own prices. Prices should for all those commodities should not be generated in London or in New York. These are our commodities, and we can organize our economic space in such a way that the price formation for those commodities will satisfy our needs, not needs of the Western speculations, but the needs of the production sector.
Doctor, if I excuse me, so if I understand you correctly, we are looking maybe at a special international currency, not a national currency, but one that is backed by the national currencies and the commodities, and that so
yes.
is this correct? Did I understand this correctly? That yes, this would
the
then
idea,
be.
Go
ahead, please.
The idea is to create the new world currency, which could be used.